There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 957. I'm very excited about this particular podcast, but I'll get to that in a second because let's talk about you. The ID10T community and the ID10T community corkboard, which you can submit stuff to our very own producer extraordinaire Katie Levine at corkboard@ID10T.com. Kale writes, our clothing company, Thank You Worldwide, is an attempt to share our lifestyle and the positive feeling we all get after a day of doing what we love. Most importantly, it's a reminder not to take ourselves too seriously and be thankful. As a skateboarding brand, our mission is to show the world the positive side of skateboarding and provide a creative platform for skateboarders, musicians, and artists to express themselves through collaboration while creating high-quality clothing in the process. People can check out our stuff, thankyouww.com. Get 20% off if you use the offer code ID10T. Very nice of you, Kale. Also, with so many shows to watch and games to play, how do you know what's worth your time? But now there's a weekly web series called Stream Economy to help you figure out what to watch and what to pass on. Host Ashley Escada talks about, oh, I love Ashley. She's great. Talks about all the weekly news and pop culture while reminding you to buy or sell for viewers on shows and games. Check it out every Friday on youtube.com/CNET. Well done, Ashley Escada. Let's see. Oh, I don't know. I guess David Tennant has returned to the podcast. David Tennant, who, I don't know, might have just been, the 10th Doctor in a small British series by the name of Doctor Who. He was on in 2011, and, I was over in London and got to chat with him, and yeah, he's a frigging great guy. I mean, just the best dude that you would want him to be in real life. So he came over to the house, and I posted a picture on Instagram. My Instagram is at Hardwick. I posted a picture on Instagram of us because I have a TARDIS in the house. And I was very... I turned into like a 12-year-old, like, hi, you know, I got this thing downstairs. And, I mean, if you don't want to, you don't have to take a picture with it. But if you want to take a picture with it, it'd be great. I was really embarrassed. I don't know. I just didn't want to think I'm a creepy super fan. Why? Because I'm a creepy super fan. That's why. I just don't want him to know that. He's in a movie called Bad Samaritan, which is in theaters today, May 4th. He plays not a nice man at all. And he's great. And also Robert Sheen's in this movie. And if you know who he is, he was in a show called Misfits, which was great. And he's been in a million other things. And he's a fantastic actor, too. So Bad Samaritan, directed by Dean Devlin, in theaters right now. Starring Mr. David Tennant, who is right here on the ID10T podcast, number 957, Katie Levine.
May the fourth be with you.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Especially if they're doing junkets, and then you go,
yeah.
"Let's start now."
Yeah, of course.
You kind of watch. You watch them. Get
yeah,
tense.
Without a doubt.
And then a little defensive body posture.
Yeah.
Just.
Oh no, it's a very good policy.
Yeah, because you don't.
And I fell into your trap.
You did a little bit, but it's a safe trap because
yeah,
you'll
fine.
Never. You'll never. We'll never. I don't want to get anything out of anyone that they
yeah.
don't want to be public.
Sure.
Because I certainly wouldn't want that. I'm so terrified in interviews now because occasionally they'll just start throwing kind of incendiary questions just to see
yeah.
how you respond.
Yeah.
And your mind starts racing. You're like, don't fuck this up.
Well, also because now that there's that sense that anything you say can be you have to be sort of overthinking every context as
yes.
it comes.
Yep. Yes.
Because something that you meant one way is delivered a different way, and suddenly you're, well, I don't know who you are, but you're in jail and you're...
Yeah. It's the clickbait thing. It's like you could take just a fraction of a sentence that was like you were even as if you were talking as someone else, and then they'll take that and say, you know, Chris Hardwick said this.
Well, I just right now, basically, I just feel with that stuff. I feel a little bit like a tender lamb walking through a lion pen, and I'm just like, please don't eat me.
Yeah,
you know, just like please. Though I just need to protect the tenderest meat.
Yeah,
and so it's. You know, if you go through the airports and they start shouting questions and you're like, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
I don't know anything.
I am mute. Yeah.
But you just talked. No, I don't. It's a reflex. Yeah, it's a nerve.
But it's slightly scary, that appetite for scandal or outrage is a bit overpowering, a bit overwhelming.
Yeah,
It is. I mean, I'd hate to be a politician or something in this age.
Oh.
Just that sense that. Although, apparently, if you're Donald Trump, you can just say what the hell you like. And then just deny it later.
Yeah.
I never said that. Well, it is on tape.
Nah, I don't think so.
Fake news.
No.
Okay.
But I think when I hang out with people who tend to seem very well adjusted and happy and in general good sense of well-being, I think like, oh, you're not on social media that much. I don't peg you as like much of a social media guy.
No, I'm not on it at all.
Yeah.
I have no profiles anywhere.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. And my wife does it a bit. So I can see it over her shoulder. But I just don't. When it started to explode, I think, was just when I was feeling for the first time a bit kind of known, I guess. A bit kind of ubiquitous, which makes you feel like you've just sort of lost a layer of skin, I think, initially.
Yeah.
So I think I thought, well, I can't possibly touch that. That's toxic. And now nobody really cares anymore. I probably could dip a toe if I wanted to. But I feel like I sort of missed the moment. And now I think the fact that I'm not on it is almost a position I feel sort of faintly... I feel like a sort of mad old granddad who can be like, no, I don't do any of that. Why should I do any of that? Stuff and nonsense.
Yes.
I mean, maybe eventually we will all go there. Maybe it's like, maybe I'm the sort of person who didn't have a mobile phone in 2001. Maybe it's sort of going, why? No, I'm not going to do it. Nobody does that. Maybe one day I'll have given in and gone,
it's possible you might. I know my dad, only until the last couple of years he was alive, refused to text. No, if you want to talk, pick up the phone.
Right, yeah.
And then he started experimenting with it and then immediately was like, well, this is great. I mean, if I can't get you on them, I'm like, that's what I've been telling you for years,
you know?
And so he immediately, then he became a texter. Then he went through all those waves of novice texting of like sending
all caps.
Yeah. Just sending things and pictures. Yeah. Hey, have you seen that? Yes, I've seen that. Yeah. You know,
send this to five of your friends or we're in deep shit.
No, Dad, please stop sending people money. Please just calm down. Maybe that'll be you in social media someday.
It might be actually, yes, really, really bad at it. But loving it.
Well, maybe. Because your kids are, I would imagine, it's soonish are going to start to be old enough to be citizens of the internet. And I'm sure
my 16-year-old is down deep in it, of course.
Oh, I didn't realize you had a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
So he's all over it. The 7-year-old, probably any minute.
Absolutely. Any second. Yeah. It might be happening now.
Yeah. No, it's part of the world, isn't it? And I'm slightly... railing against it like a sort of King Canute figure.
Well, the interesting thing is that social media, I think, is very... I think social media as a whole really had a lot to do with, you know, when your season of Doctor Who came on, when your series first started, and people were like, oh my God, it's so fucking good. They had a place to go connect.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And here in the States, because as you know, like before that reboot or continuation of the series... Doctor Who was really only known by like a group of like a select group of people.
Sure.
There was the Gallifrey One convention has been going on for a long time, but it was not a big.
Yes, it was a point of 1%.
Yeah,
point something.
Yeah, like
zero
the guy
something.
With the scarf, that weird, with the rubber mask aliens.
Yeah,
that's the one. You know, and social media really gave those people a place to connect and totally.
Social media clearly is a wonderful thing when it's used right. I'm nervous of it because I know. I would feel the pressure to be interesting, funny, witty, unique, And that really makes me kind of... and I spend all day crafting the thing to say because I worry I didn't get it. I wasn't clever enough or funny enough or interesting enough and my photos weren't cool enough. And it would give me... It would just give me more things to be anxious about, and I've got enough of them.
Yeah, yeah, no, the thing that you have to have a hot take on something is just terrible. It's not fun.
I think now there are people that are, I think people are cooler without it. You know, there are some people that I know who are like, yeah, it's really,
sure, keep talking.
You can't track them down. Yeah. No, it's cool. It is cool. There is sort of a, like, not needing it is kind of a cool place to be.
I do like the idea that there isn't a place where people can go to for my opinion on things.
Right.
I think that sense that if you've got a Twitter account and something happens that you'd be expected to have an opinion about.
Sure.
It's then he said blah on Twitter. Or even worse, he said nothing on Twitter, which in itself then becomes a comment. So I'd rather not have that sort of that place where people can go and see what I didn't say about something.
I notice with some people where it's like I'll say, yeah, I'll get off Twitter for months at a time, and people go, man, I wish I was in a position in my career where I could do that. That's what I hear a lot of. People feel that they have to have it.
And people use it brilliantly to promote themselves.
Yeah, it's like, and if they have like a certain amount of followers, they can get booked certain gigs, you know? Mm-hmm. It's I don't want to say sad because it's like I've probably benefited from it at times, but it's I don't want it to be that way, you know.
Well, it's nice when if you're in a position where you can work and the work can speak for itself and you don't feel like you have to be your own marketer constantly.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I gotta. And it's also great for you, I imagine, because I'm sure when you work on stuff and they go, hey, so social media, can you tweet out? Nope, sorry.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Exactly.
Can't live tweet anything. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. No. Yep, don't
Not
have any
me.
Of it. But I think, you know, what's really excited me about watching your career, especially since Doctor Who, is that did you feel that before your series, before the reboot of the show, there was kind of a thing where if you were a doctor, that was sort of your branding for life. You know, like, just like, well, that you're stuck with that for a long time. Do you think any of the other doctors struggled with, oh, I kind of want to do other things, but people see me so much as this character? Or,
I mean, you'd have to ask them, I suppose, how they felt about it. But I think that there was certainly a sense in the industry that that's what it... I remember when it was offered to me, the first of the new lot of the series, the Christopher Eccleston season, hadn't aired. And my agent in London at the time was saying, oh, I don't think we can do that. Because it would be so defining. And it is very defining. It is one of those shows that because it has such a reach, because it is so loved, because it's so ubiquitous in it, because it crosses sort of boundaries of class, of gender, of international boundaries, of ages. It's one of those shows that doesn't have a kind of specific audience. It's quite broad. So it does it does sort of brand you in a way, but, you know, and it follows you around. But I found that's been a positive rather than a negative. It's not been so overwhelming that it stopped me doing other things. And certainly... my father-in-law, who, by weird quirk of the universe, was also a doctor once, he's had a career that has never
stopped. Peter Davison.
Yeah, Peter Davison. And he's done a wide variety of things and continues to this day. He's absolutely known as the Fifth Doctor, but he's also known as Tristan Farnan and a whole bunch of other things that he's done. So I don't... And, you know, that was back in the 80s he did it. So it didn't... I don't think it was... I don't think he would describe it as something that was limiting.
I don't know if Jonah is aware of the calculus behind this, but David's wife technically played the doctor's daughter.
She did play my daughter. She did play my daughter. You can say it, Chris.
Played his daughter on the series.
But I was 900 years old, so it's fine.
I know. You're probably 907. So she played his daughter on the show, but in real life, she is the daughter of a doctor. So there's this very interesting... kind of recursive math that happens in the
exactly.
I'm sure he's real stoked when people bring it up too.
But it's it's fun though because it's kind of a that the show is so special for so many reasons and then personally special at the same time, you know. But going back to what you were saying before is it was hard to watch you leave, but I think for your career you probably left at the right time. Like it's not if you had done it for like 6 or 7 years. then it's like, okay, well, that's what that guy, you know, well, that's probably what that guy does.
It's always impossible to know, isn't it? Because you can't tell how things would have worked out differently. And but of course, that was part of the reasoning behind knowing when to jump off. Is do you want to do this? Do you want this to be the only thing you do?
Yeah.
Because I could easily have gone on. I was having a ball. It was a great job. And I loved it. And I loved the people. And it would have been working with Stephen Moffat, which would have been fantastic because I love him and I love his writing. And he was taking over the show. And I could easily... But then you sort of think, at some point, I'm going to have to leave this. I can't do this. Even if I did this until they kicked me out, I would still... I mean, I don't know how long I could have lasted. Maybe, how long could you feasibly last? Maybe 10 years. Maybe.
Right, yeah, right.
There would still come an end point, and I would still be a relatively young human being. So, you know, you have to kind of be thinking, I don't want this to be the very last thing I do, obviously.
Sure.
But who knows? Who knows? It's impossible to tell. I think you just have to, it just became the time to leave was right because Russell T. Davis was going and Julie Gardner was going, and that was... We felt like a team, so
sure.
It felt if I'd gone on with another team, and that would have felt well, it was an obvious jumping off point. And if I hadn't taken that one, I may never have left.
Well, yeah, because I think a lot of fans interpreted your last moment of saying like I don't want to go as you say. They're like, oh my god, he's saying he doesn't.
That well, part in a of- sense, that was true, I think, but it was also that was Russell T. Davis saying that too.
Right. Oh, interesting.
I mean, he wrote that line.
It is probably the most heartbreaking regeneration.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah,
it really was hard. It was one of those ones where you watch it, you got to stop, and you're like, oh, god damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to be all right.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of the show is that it teaches you so much about life and death in the sense that you lose people on the show that you love, and then someone new comes along, and you're like... I don't know about this.
Yeah.
And then
you go, I love them more.
No one said that. I ran into Matt Smith while cosplaying as the 10th Doctor at Comic-Con one year because I was doing panels. I did Doctor Who, so I dressed as...
Right, right, right.
And I ran into him at a party and he was like, oh, I see how it is. You know, I got a tweed jacket at home too. I just
what came out of the closet today.
What are you gonna do? Yeah. Yeah. The suit chose me
I
today.
I could just as easily have been Colin Baker.
But you know, was it important? Like immediately, because was Broadchurch the first thing after Doctor Who?
No, it wasn't. No, Broadchurch was quite a way past, actually. A couple of years down the line, yeah.
Did you think I want to take a break for a bit, or did you think, you know, I want to do something that's very different from what I was just doing?
I ever thought that tactically, I would have a great story to tell, maybe. No, I can't even remember what the first thing I did was. What was it? It may have been St. Trinian's 2, The Legend of Fritton's Gold. You've seen that over the... That played very big in LA.
It was huge.
Huge.
Yeah, yes. I think it's still playing at the...
Rep theaters weekly. It's become a midnight movie.
Egyptian.
I've just always gone, oh, that looks like fun. That fits in. Great, do that.
And then do you find that your gut serves you well in that sense? I'm like, do you have a pretty good relationship with your... When you read something, you go, yeah, great, fun, sure, fine.
I can't think of anything I regret doing, which I suppose would answer your question, I suppose.
Yeah.
But then I'm quite easily pleased as well. I sort of go, oh, this is fun. Well, look, these are nice people. It's a nice job, isn't it? That's nice.
You don't look for life fulfillment and happiness through your work? You find it in like real life scenarios, like family?
Quite family.
Eventually, yes. Eventually it turns out that's sort of what it's all about.
Yeah. So that fills the hole.
Well, but also, again, like in work-wise, I do find myself quite... Certainly, in terms of the making of it, making of something, I do find much to love in most things. So I'm quite I do find turning up to work and going, oh, this is fun, and I like that person, and it's nice to see that person. I mean, ultimately the end result, I may not look back on as fondly, but I don't have a lot of things that I think, oh, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, but the process is enough for you.
Tends to be positive. Yeah.
Well, and also I think. You get to do a lot of fun stuff, and you realize when you watch people who live their lives that way, you realize like, oh yeah, I guess I don't have to pile on all the external stress that goes along with this thing.
Yeah.
I could just, you know.
I mean, I'm not. That's not to say that I haven't had some some jobs that have been tricky or that have had tensions and that have come with some attendant anxieties. Absolutely, that's the case. But sort of generally speaking, I sort of bound along quite happily, I think.
Nice. I think people were rattled a little bit at how good and dark you were in Jessica Jones. Because they, you know, I would see people online being like, he's so good and this is disturbing and I don't know how I feel about this.
Right.
Because I have this place in my heart for this other character that he played and now I'm seeing this side. Yeah. And that's really unsettling.
Yeah.
And because Kilgrave was a great, I mean, he was obviously a selfish character, but in those moments where he was like, well, you know, how would you feel if you never knew if someone was wanted to be friends with you because they liked you or because you were telling them what to do?
Mm.
And there were moments where you almost kind of empathize with him a little
bit. Absolutely. I think he's in a difficult position. I mean, yes, he's something of a monster, but I don't think it's hard for him to appreciate that. And I think that, I think it came at an extraordinary time, that show. And I think, the echoes of sort of what it, the conversations that it began about sexual politics and things.
Yes.
It came at a time when people were beginning to think about that. And of course, that's a conversation that's still entirely relevant and going on. And I think what's interesting is a character like Kilgrave's ignorance about how ignorant he was being. And I think it's sort of fascinating about what we're seeing about a lot of male psychologies.
Yes.
In lots of areas of our society. But I think it really caught the beginning of a wave there, actually, that story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
And I do want to make it clear, it's not that I empathize with him that much at all.
No.
But just that he did have a couple human moments in the show where you're like, oh, I don't know if that. Then, of course, you know, then makes his father shove his hands in the disposal.
Yeah,
and
no, he's a monster. Absolutely, he's a monster. And I'm not for a minute suggesting we should empathize with him. But that, as your job as an actress, that's what you've got to do in that moment, of course. But I just think he's in a complicated situation, which makes him a fascinating character. Because how could he if everything that he suggests is people acquiesce around him at any given moment, how can he ever build a moral framework from that?
Yeah.
And so his...
This was my defense of him.
But then his answer is just to embrace it 1,000% and, you know, control everyone.
It is, but only because, you know, he's maybe not that bright, ultimately.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Kevin?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just even that sort of expression of, you know, who he wants to be. If he didn't have that power, he'd just be some fucking angry guy on the internet whose screen name was Kilgrave.
Yeah. Absolutely,
he'd be Kevin at the video store.
Absolutely. Quite.
Just some other incel.
Yeah, exactly. But you you just came from the Corden show, which you said you and James haven't seen each other in quite a while.
Many, many years, yes. Well, I think I last saw him before he came off to conquer Hollywood, really. Which was 4 or 5 years ago now. Yeah.
And was it? So this was way after he was on Doctor Who.
Yeah. Although, yes, even then, I suppose. I mean, we never knew each other very well, but we were just sort of on the circuit at the time. We were sort of National Theatre circuit and that kind of world. We knew each other from. Yeah.
So how does it? This is a dumb American question, sure. And I apologize. Can you explain a bit how the National Theatre works? You're a part of the company, and then are there several companies that sort of tour, or do you just? Is it one main company that has one specific show, or how does it work?
There's sort of no one answer to that. The National Theatre is based in the South Bank in London, and there's three main spaces there that are usually doing a number of shows at the same time, which are often in repertory with each other.
So there aren't touring companies.
And there are also sometimes our touring companies. Okay. Yeah. And then sometimes a show, for instance, the one that James did, One Man, Two Governors, very famously, started at the National Theatre and then transferred into the West End for a while. So it was running in London's West End, and then the National Theatre carried on the South Bank with other stuff.
Right.
So, yes, the shows from there will go out and will go around the world as well, but it's based in those three spaces in the South Bank.
And is it funded by the government?
In part, yes.
Yeah. So it's in a way, like when you're an actor in the national company, you're almost kind of a government employee.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's not solely funded by the government.
Yeah,
there's arts council funding. There's also sponsorship. There's also ticket sales as well. But the arts council is one of its I don't know, maybe 50% of their income.
Yeah, that's really great.
And do you pick and choose what you want to do, or do they sort of assign and go, okay, you should do this and you should do this and this?
You tend to come for a play. Mm-hmm. You get employed to do whatever, and then sometimes you'll maybe stay and do two or three, or you'll come in and do one and go again, or it changes really.
And then from there, you're required to either do a Harry Potter film or some kind of upstairs downstairs type of
possibly Game of Thrones.
Yeah, or possibly Game of Thrones.
The other option. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And you haven't done? Have you ever done it? Have you ever done like an upstairs downstairs type of?
Not really, I did an Anthony Trollope.
Okay.
4-part BBC tight collar funny hat drama.
The funny hat dramas are my favourite kind of drama.
Yes, that was a while ago now, but so I've done a bit of that, yeah, but I've never done Game of Thrones.
No, but you did do a Harry Potter.
I did do a Harry Potter, yes.
Yes, 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 yes. So you are part of, you do get to be a part of that. I kind of feel bad for some British actors who are like, oh, I didn't get to be in Harry Potter.
I know. I feel very fortunate to have got in there. Although now they've sort of started up again with the Fantastic Beasts
franchise.
So there's can I be in that as well? Does anyone cross over?
Yeah. I feel like I'd be cool if I just said, sure, you could cross over. Yeah.
Could we send an email now?
You absolutely could. You know what, though? Because of the time frame of Fantastic Beasts, I don't think there's any reason that there couldn't be like a Bertie Crouch appearance in some... Because it takes place... at the beginning of the 1900s.
Yeah.
So maybe there's some sort of maybe you've gone back and, or it's an ancestor.
Sure. I'll take whatever. I'm not proud. But do any actors turned up in both as playing different characters?
I don't believe so. No. No, it's totally separate. And I think it's probably part of the separation is that I think it's J.K. Rowling's, like, she wrote, like, these are hers.
Yeah.
Whereas the other ones were based off the books, but these are actually hers.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think if it's possible, she actually has even more ownership over them.
Yeah.
Just to see if she can become a double billionaire from the books.
Yeah, I know.
Are your kids into any of that?
Harry Potter, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite recently, the Harry Potter. I mean, my 16-year-old grew up through them and sort of enjoyed the films and so on. But the younger ones are getting into them now. Yeah. When we were over here, we took them to Harry Potter World.
Nice.
Oh, Universal?
Yeah. Kind of.
That's the most brilliant. Exciting. Have you been?
No, I want to really badly.
The thing that's brilliant about it, and I know this sounds gross and I apologize. The thing that's brilliant about it is that it's basically a mall. There are two rides.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But there are
two rides, one of which is brilliant.
Yes.
One of which is a bit rubbish.
You probably like the motion ride, like where you're going through and you're on the Quidditch pitch.
Yeah,
and it's
all the actors are in there going, quick, follow me.
Yeah, exactly.
Michael Gambon just up in the end. That's great.
The other one's just like a little roller coastery thingy.
A little roller coaster.
Yeah, but that's universal. Like, their rides are very either great or terrible.
Right. As an employee of NBC Universal, Jonah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, take it out.
but it's essentially a mall because it's Diagon Alley, and Diagon Alley was a mall.
It's true.
Yeah,
it was the Third Street Promenade of Harry Potter.
And of course, it's festooned in snow, so you're in the baking California sunshine with all this fake snow around you, which is quite weird. Is that because it's always snowing in England?
I think that's how we see it over there. Yeah, I think that's how we see it.
It's not.
It pretty much is.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty gray. Yeah. But they do so they do these things where it's like if you buy, well, first of all, you have to go to the wand shop.
Yeah.
And I'm sure every parent dreads it because there's a whole thing that happens in the wand shop where it's like the spotlight goes on, all the boxes fly
around and
points to one kid and they're like, "You found your wand." But then they open the door, and then the parents have to buy that wand.
Oh, wow.
But the one who gets picked out, because we didn't get picked out, we just watched it, do they not get given something for being picked out? Or do they still have to spend $89.99?
Yeah. I feel like they... I don't know. I think they might have to buy... I think they might have to buy the wand. I think. I don't know, though. I don't know.
There must be some sort of fee for being part of the entertainment.
Yeah. You're put in the show.
Yeah. I'm a SAG, and... I don't know. But the wands, you stand in certain spots around the area.
Well, I didn't know about this.
You didn't?
No, nobody told us. We just wandered around. There's like magic stuff you can do.
Yes, wave the wands in certain spots, like you wave it at a store window and a bunch of shit happens in the store window. And so
the whole thing is kind of an attraction.
The whole thing is an attraction, but at the core of it, it's a mall, and then there's the candy shop, and they sell chocolate frogs, and they sell butter beer, which is like a real sugary, non-alcoholic beverage.
What is butter beer?
I think it's just liquid sugar. I don't know what it is, but it tasted to me just like liquid sugar. So I didn't react well to it.
Right.
Broke out immediately.
Yeah, exactly. It's not what I envisioned what they were drinking in the book. Like, yeah.
No, it sounds delicious.
Yeah,
it sounds delicious.
I don't know what it sounds like. It tastes like though, butter beer.
I guess I would imagine it's probably a little savory with a layer of sweet, but this was just pure.
I'd say like a cider, but like with a Guinness quality to it.
But kids drink it, right? So it's not alcohol.
But no. Isn't the idea that it's alcohol? Alcoholic in their world?
I don't know.
Well, so if you're a fledgling wizard, you can get pissed. Well,
you know what though? Because you can drink at 16 in the UK, right? Isn't 16 the age?
Yeah.
So I think in the books, I think they're not allowed to go into town until like a certain year. Like I don't think they can go into town to that pub.
You think they get drunk on butter beer?
I think it's don't.
You're a fucking Patronus. I know my fucking Patronus. You don't tell me. I got a cat for a Patronus. I got a little cat.
So do your littlest kids, do they understand what it is that you do, and they understand the separation between?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah, I think they understand the separation. That's always been a thing for me when people have said, oh, kids don't understand the difference between fantasy and reality. As a child, I absolutely did.
Right.
I remember. Part of the reason I got so into Doctor Who is I remember, and I can date this because I know when it was on the telly, I remember seeing John Pertwee turn into Tom Baker and going, that's amazing. And having it explained to me that they were actors telling a story and understanding what that was. And from that point on, precociously, wanting to be an actor. So I must have understood that at that age. And my kids seem to get that from that sort of an age.
Yeah, I would just imagine everyone's a million times savvier now about everything.
Yeah, exactly,
Because everything's so ubiquitous and everyone's talking about everything all the time. And it's someday when we have kids and I'm going to tell them the story of like when I was growing up, the television would just turn off at a certain hour, and then there was no television until 7 o'clock in the morning.
Imagine it seems like prehistory now, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get stressed because I just think, like, what did we do?
Yeah.
How did we and I think, oh, people just live their lives.
Read books.
They read books. Yeah. They talk to each other.
Turned the light out, went to sleep.
They didn't
have a blue glow by the side of their bed.
Yeah. No.
Oh, I'll just hit my emails at 4 in the morning. Never do that!
Nope. I'll just read two and then I'll go back to sleep. Now I'm awake. Didn't really work out this way.
But now Apple have given you that thing where the light goes a little bit mellow in the middle. Yeah. Makes no difference.
Yeah.
How about a little night shift?
Yeah.
I'm still awake.
Still awake.
The night shift doesn't stop the gears in my brain from spinning a million miles an hour because I'm answering emails at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Put it away from your bed. That's what I've been starting to do. I put it on the other side of the room.
I know.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, this is the last time you were on and I forgot. But does the name...
Are we doing pickups from 2011?
I'm going to edit this back into the 2011.
Finally put out that episode.
Retrospectively.
This isn't for now. I'm just going to take the...
This is the George Lucas, Chris Hardwick version of the podcast. Right.
There's going to be a CG Jabba that's going to just walk through it. He's going to look
shitty. You know, I saw that the other day because my kids have the Star Wars movies on Blu-ray, but it's the rejigged version. That bit where Jabba the Hutt.
Unnecessary.
And now, of course, it just looks rubbish.
Yeah, it does.
Because that technology has moved on so fast.
Oh, yeah. So incredibly fast. You know,
and when he did it, I remember thinking, that's really clever.
I mean, you can only kind of see that his foot cuts the plane.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's good for... But I was watching the first Avengers movie because I had just seen Infinity War. And I remember at the time thinking the first Avengers movie was like, these effects are amazing. And the ones in Infinity War are a million times better than the ones just from the first Avengers.
Right,
so even in that time, it's already come a long way. But it was does the name Tennant, was that taken from Neil Tennant of the Pet Shop Boys?
I mean, it kind of was. Yeah, it was taken out of an edition of Smash Hits, which was a sort of teenage music magazine. Because I was 16 and I had to change my name for the Actors Union Equity.
Right, because there was already a person
with your name. David McDonald in Equity.
Hard to believe in Scotland.
I know. Well, it was the whole of Britain.
All of the UK.
So I thought, I'm 16. I don't know how. I didn't know any actors. I don't know. How do you go about changing your name? So I leafed through a copy of Smash Hits. My first option was David Brandon. Remember Kirk Brandon, Spear of Destiny? Why would you?
Oh, no, I don't.
You'll never take me alive. That was one of his songs.
Oh, my God, I don't know this.
Yeah. I hope you can get clearance for that.
I think it would be like, could you please sing more? We really need to sing more. Please just...
That was my first choice, which would have been better. For alphabetical cast lists, I would have done much better than David Brandon.
Oh, yes, take an A or a B if you're going to change your name.
David Aardvark.
Aardvark, David Aardvark. Perfect. Would have been amazing.
So I did that first, and then Tennant was my second choice. And that, there was obviously a David Brandon as well. So I
of course.
It came back through the post, your name is now David Tennant. And I remember going... Oh, what have I done? This is crazy. How can I live with this different name?
Well, my family think.
And then after a while, you get used to it.
Do you think of yourself as a Tennant or a McDonald's?
I know I'm a Tennant.
You are.
And that's because when I came to America to work, there's a different actors union here, and they already had a David Tennant.
Oh, shit.
So then they said, you'll have to change your name. I said, but I've been working for like 10 years. I'm not George Clooney, but people have heard of me. It's going to be really weird if I've got a different name in one country to the name I've got back home. And I went to Actors Equity in Britain. None of them are going to thank me for telling this story. Mm-hmm. I went to Actors Equity in Britain. I went, can you sort this out? Of course we will. This is ridiculous. They're never going to be able to make you change your name. And I got 2 days later, they phoned back and went, yeah, SAG are not listening. So I'm afraid we've been beaten by them. So I'm like, well, what am I going to do? And then I find there's a loophole. SAG are really not going to thank me for that. But I'm fully paid up, so...
It's all fine.
There's a loophole that somebody, because it's America, took them to court and said, this is my legal name. You can't make me change my name from my legal name.
Oh.
Won the case. So there's a loophole that if it's your legal name, they can't make you change it. So I changed my name to David Tennant legally so that I could... remain David Tennant on both sides of the Atlantic.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you didn't have to come here and be like, David A. Tennant.
Which would have been so bizarre. But it presumably means there's another David Tennant working somewhere in the industry.
Did you never look him up to see what he does?
I couldn't find anything. But I'm sure he's hugely successful and very well thought of.
With a name like that.
My poor Googling skills couldn't find it. But apparently so, yeah.
Sure. Have you ever met... Were you a Pet Shop Boys fan?
Do you know, I was a Pet Shop Boys fan.
I still am.
I think they're a fantastic band. I love this stuff. I've never met Neil Tennant.
So really?
I have no idea if he knows that he's my actual father.
I feel like there's someone... I feel like it'd be probably the Graham Norton show. Like if the Graham Norton show caught wind of that... He would get Neil Tennant to come on and do a segment.
Neil Tennant could be very underwhelmed by the whole thing. I don't know how he would feel about it. He seems very cool.
He seems
much more cool than me.
He seems pretty... Well, yes, he probably was pretty cool because I think, if I remember correctly, he was basically a music critic.
He worked for Smash Hits.
Yes.
The magazine that I took his name out of. Yeah.
And it was like, I could do this. Yeah. And it turned out he was right.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
Could. Even though he wasn't really a vocalist per se, he just kind of sings down here the whole time.
He's got quite a nice kind of, but yes, it's a particular sound he has.
It's very, 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 it's very unique. And ultimately, those songs... If they came out today, I'd be like, I buy it. I totally
songs.
Buy it.
They're great songwriters.
They're really, really, really great songs. I think that's going to be the ultimate goal of the universe is to figure out how to get the two of you together. But you're right. It would be. I mean, you must have... I'm sure you have.
And also, wouldn't it be one of those moments you go, hi, Neil, hi, I took your name from Smash Hits. Yeah, I've heard.
Well,
and that's it.
So I guess, do we order the appetizers then? I'll just get the check. Yeah. I'll just get the check.
Really like your music. I bought some CDs. Could you sign them?
Are there people that you've like super fanned out over and had that experience? Because as someone where people do that to you all the time, I would imagine... Do you also empathize in a way? Are there people that you've met where you...
Without a doubt, yeah. Billy Connolly.
Oh,
nice.
Big time. Because he was someone, especially growing up, he was someone my dad introduced me to. And he was always... And also, he is fucking brilliant.
Yes.
He's about the best stand-up comedian I think probably there has ever been.
Right.
I did a movie with him. And I was so excited and also very nervous because he was just such a massive figure from my childhood and my whole life. And then he didn't disappoint at all. Not for a second. He was as warm as he appears. He was as funny as he appears. He was generous. He was easy. He was everything you could have hoped for. Yeah.
Did you kind of spill the beans on the...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did. Oh, good.
Yeah. And again, he didn't disappoint there, because I'd talk about the old cassette tapes we used to listen to, and he'd do little bits. You know, I'd say, oh, yeah, we used to listen to that. Right, because my dad was a minister in the Church of Scotland. Billy Connolly does this very blasphemous routine about the crucifixion. My dad used to love it.
Oh, nice.
And we'd listen to it together, and I would, you know, I would tell him, oh, that bit where he tells... he tells Judas to shut up, and his face was shut. So, and everything, you know, he remembered all the bits, and he did the bits, and he was, yeah, he just perfection.
Well, I went to the Fringe Festival probably 20 years ago. I've never performed in it, but I went 20 years ago, and Billy Connolly was, I was a huge fan of his, and so in my mind, like, oh, that's. You know, he is the prime example of a Scottish comic.
Yeah.
And I watched, I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to see other Scottish comics. And I'm sorry to say, I could not, I had difficulty understanding some of the, like, the bro, it was so fast and hard. I thought, am I dumb? Why am I not? Right. I couldn't understand.
No, I mean, I'm amazed he travels as far as he does, really, because it does seem... to me, very of where I come from, his stuff. But I think he does go. I mean,
well, this wasn't him. This was other comics.
Other comics, yeah.
Yeah.
Billy did manage to sort of transcend, travel the world.
Yeah, because he did. He came and he had a career here, too. He came and did a sitcom here.
Didn't he do it? Yeah, he did a sitcom.
He
did. Top of the Class or something.
Head of the Class.
Yeah,
he replaced. Did you ever see a show called WKRP in Cincinnati? Did you guys get that?
Yes.
Okay. So there was
a blast from the past.
It sure was.
Yeah.
So there was the guy who played the DJ on there was a guy named Howard Hessman, and Howard Hessman was the original star of this show, Head of the Class.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, the show was supposed to sort of be a little bit edgier about this guy who's kind of a fuck up and he's got these kids. And then the show kind of flipped and became more of like the kids rule the classroom.
Right.
And I think he was like, yeah, not
right,
so much.
Right.
And then Billy Connolly came in and he did like a season or two of it.
But he did a Columbo as well.
He did.
Billy Connolly is the adversary in a Columbo episode.
Holy shit.
I think one of the last ones.
That's incredible. I didn't know that.
Peter Falk was 107 years old.
I'm going to buy it.
I think you should be retired from the police force by now, but I'm glad you're not.
I'm going to buy that.
Yeah.
Did you ever think you would try stand-up? Was stand-up ever a thing that you wanted to do?
Not at all. No. No. Really not. Because also you have to write your own stuff. I love it when other people write stuff. If somebody wrote me a stand-up routine, I'd have a go. But I wouldn't know. I think it's a... It's got about finding your own voice, isn't it? And it's about, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I'd be too scared. I've done one-man things a couple of times. It's absolutely bum-clenching. Not having someone else to kind of riff off. And
well, I would be terrified of doing a one-man thing because stand-up, you can control everything. And if things aren't working, you can take turns and, you know, go into the audience if you need to or fuck around. But if you're just doing, like, a written one-person show...
Yeah.
And the audience 5 minutes in just isn't that into it.
Yeah.
It's not, you have to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you can't break the fourth wall and be like, guys, just, this will be over soon. Like, there's nothing you can do in the middle of that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you miss doing, do you go back? Do you think like, oh, I want to go back and just do theater for a while?
I do. I mean, I did a play last year. I'm sure I'll do another one before too long. It's part of what I do. It's part of my, it feels like the day job.
Yeah.
That feels like proper work.
Yeah.
Not because it's harder work necessarily. It's just, it feels, there's something a bit more, I don't know, artisan about it, isn't there?
Well, there is actually, because you can't, there aren't really any shortcuts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, you have to go and be in the moment and you can't go, oh, I'll do that again. Or you really have to learn how to work with a group and listen, I guess.
Mm.
I mean, was there anything that, when you first made the jump from theater to film and television, did you have habits that you had to break or things that you had to relearn or things that were harder or things that were easier?
There wasn't sort of a moment where I stopped doing one and started doing another. I was always doing, you know, I did more theatre than TV stuff because that's the work I got.
Right.
But I was always doing like an episode of this or a bit of that. So it was always, it was a sort of slow learning curve on both in both mediums, really.
Well, were you ever able to get out of a play because you got a gig in television or movies?
No, I've never done. I've never had to do that. Never been that much in demand. I think that's a Broadway thing as well. In London, you don't really do that in London. You do if you're doing a play, you're doing a play.
You're just no understudies.
They call it a Betterment clause or something, don't they? Or a get some kind of that you can get on Broadway. That if I get a better job, I'm we don't do that.
I mean, this is fine.
We don't do that.
Yeah, it's not a movie. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Whereas in Britain, our tradition is it's a movie, not the theatre.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, I think if you start a play, you finish a play.
You mean you're not obsessed with fame at all costs? That's crazy.
I think there's still a thing in certain. There's an idea in Britain though that's the worthy stuff to do. That's where you get your knighthood. You get your knighthood from doing plays in the West End. You know, you don't get your knighthood from doing popular television series.
I don't know. I think Patrick Stewart got it from playing Captain Picard and Professor Xavier.
Well, maybe. Or was it his award-winning Claudius?
It could... Oh, no.
I think he was already a star by then, actually.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, I think he maybe was.
Yeah. But, so, listen, knighthood is not out of the question for you at some point.
It's not something I'm chasing.
Is there a process to it? Like, are there people that go like, I want to try and have a career where I get knighted?
No. The process is if you chase it, you don't get one.
But
that's not why I was doing that. Okay. That was not a double thing. No. But it's all because it's British and all that. It's all sort of all about kind of, you know, don't make it look like you think you're worth something. It's all that. How grotesque that you might have some kind of self-belief. No, it's all about sort of, you know, being nominated and people writing letters, I think.
Yeah.
And then there's an invitation from Downing Street. If you were to be offered this kind of an honour, would you accept it so that you can't turn it down?
Oh, wow.
Well,
we have pieces of concrete with stars on them on a street.
Yes.
That's what we have.
And can we quite actively campaign to get one as well?
Yeah. Technically... You
just buy them?
You pay for them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's a, you know, I can't just be like, hey, give me a star, here's a check, you know? Sure. But if there's a... There's a petition, and like... Then they approve it, you know, then there is a fee, and then you can do it.
And do they just keep spreading? Because it does feel like there's a lot of people have got stars in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Are they just spreading up and round? And
they've always been kind of pretty far.
Can they go forever?
Apart.
I mean, is there a point where it'll be full?
No.
I mean, they could get rid of some of the radio people.
You know what I noticed that they did in front of the Kodak Theater is that they've started kind of... like they used to sort of be every few steps,
yeah,
and now they're like juxtaposed. Jigsaw puzzle where it's like the corner of one is touching the corner of one in the cell next to it,
all the way up.
So they've like doubled. So I think they're in theory, and that whole sidewalk could just be stars at some point, you know.
Is there a pecking order? Like if you're Harrison Ford, you're right.
Yeah.
And if you're someone from The Bachelor season 4, you're right.
You're actually on Vine.
Yeah, you're down Vine in Santa Monica.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
On the way down.
Because you do see like in front of the Kodak Theater, it's like Billy Crystal. Like all of the big
people who should be there.
People that you would expect to be there. Because I'm sure there's also like a.
Hasn't Donald Trump got one?
Yeah.
Oh, he does. Yeah. Right.
One time someone did some street art and put like a wall around his star.
Well, that's very funny.
I thought that was
another time someone did some street art and put poop on it.
Yeah.
They really did.
It's Hollywood. That could happen.
That could happen randomly. Anywhere. That was. There was poop on a lot.
Someone put a hypodermic needle on it.
Yeah. That could just be Hollywood. I feel bad for people come to... Like, they've really cleaned up Hollywood and Highland and Vine and other... because. 10 years ago or so, like it really wasn't. I would imagine people would just show up and go, "I don't know. This is it." You know, so they've really tried. It was really, really rough. They've really tried to make it nice.
Yeah,
but it's not. You know, there's not all that. There's so much to do in Los Angeles without actually doing anything that I don't really know if people really care anymore. Like, I'm surprised that anyone thinks, you know, I'm just going to go walk down a street where there's a bunch of stuff on the sidewalk.
I guess if you come in from out of town, it's your first time and you're doing Hollywood, you probably want to say you've been there. But you probably get there and go, oh, this is it?
Yeah.
Every time a relative is in town, they're like, I want to see Hollywood. I go, All right. Okay. And we go by and they go, oh. It's, they're always underwhelmed.
Yeah. Was this a Sephora Carol Lombard shopped at?
Yeah, that's right. Well, then we went, you know, we went to Austria and then we're like right outside Mozart's apartment in Salzburg. There's a Starbucks, like literally like right out the window. So I don't know. I guess it's just part of the way our culture is going.
Of course. Yeah.
It's just globalization.
Yeah, that's all it is.
Yeah.
How do you feel like in this sort of age where there's so much, as a parent, do you feel like, oh, I want to still give my kids as many real world experiences as possible? Or do you limit their time in front of digital objects?
It's always an aspiration. And at the same time, the minute you sort of create a rule, you end up breaking it or it gets broken or, you know, but yes, you sort of muddle through. I think parenting though is a learning curve. That's what I remember. Being a child, it just seemed that parents always knew the answers to everything and that there were binary correct and wrong answers to everything in life. And really growing up, I suppose, I'm terribly profound, but growing up is the process of realising that's not the case, isn't it? And I think, but you're terribly aware that when children are young, they just accept what you tell them to be factual. And, of course, you exploit that to the hilt.
And someday they'll realize that you were faking
you were busking
most of
it. Yeah. And you think, oh, my parents were busking it too. Right. That makes sense now.
Yeah, I guess it really is just the sort of the formula of, like, if you're a parent, well, just say something.
Yeah.
You know, as I remember calling my parents, even like when I would first went away and, oh, I don't know, and they would have an answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't even know if they believed what they were telling me, but the fact is that they had an answer, and I guess that's what was most important.
It's a terrible responsibility to be handed, really. There's no guidebook.
But what's, you know...
Actually, there are lots of guidebooks.
There's a lot of guidebooks.
Loads, far too many guidebooks.
The entire industry.
Yeah.
Is there anything right now that you're particularly excited about in the world? And it doesn't have to be work, it doesn't have to be anything, but is there, like, what's something that is making you particularly joyful at the moment?
Joyful?
Yeah, is there anything?
What is making me joyful? Do you know what's making me joyful at the moment? Because I'm in LA, and I'm on my own, so I'm a bit lonely sometimes. And what sent me to a little happy place is catching up on The American Office, which I never really managed to do.
Really?
And it's on Netflix here, and it's not back home.
Oh, of course.
So I've been very much enjoying that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's
what
a
great show that was.
That is such a hard thing to do, because I think a lot of American studios and networks wrongly think that we speak the same language because a lot of the words are similar.
Yeah.
But there's such a cultural subtext that is different. So when a lot of times when they try to port a British show over to America, they don't really understand like why it actually works over there. It's like, oh, we'll just get this character and this character, and like, oh, this didn't really work at all.
Yeah.
But The Office did such an amazing job of kind of retaining the spirit, but really making it its own show.
A completely different show. And all the characters are completely recognizable, and yet they're completely different. And they're all such great actors, as indeed they were in the British show. But the sort of different types of brilliant.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
I love it. And it's very sort of comforting, and it makes me, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny to hear that it's not over there, and the, you know, I'm sure that's a matter of pride. Like, oh, you know.
Oh, no, it was. Briefly, it was. I don't know why. It's probably, people love it in the UK too, but I think it probably, I don't know, maybe Sky, of course. I don't know where it is, but it'll be somewhere. You can get everything somewhere now, can't you?
Is there a particular type of project that you haven't done yet that you would really love to do? Is there a particular type of a thing?
I never really know until it presents itself. Right now, I'm doing the closest thing to a sitcom I've probably ever done, and that's amazing. I'm loving that. I'm doing this thing called Camping, which again is a reboot of a British show, a Julia Davis show from the UK.
Oh, yeah, and that's got Brett Gelman.
That's right, it does.
And Trayvon.
Trayvon's one of the executive producers.
Yes, yeah.
One of the writers.
Yeah, so like a ton of great comedy people. Like Janixa Bravo, was she in it?
She's in there.
Yeah.
Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor have adapted it from Julia Davis's British show. So it's weird that I'm in America doing an American version of a British show I had nothing to do with.
Yeah.
But it's a half hour comedy for HBO. I mean, it's single camera, and it has its dark moments, but it's... I'm loving the idea that we sort of work, and there's a team of writers, and they'll come up after a take and go, try seeing this, I've never done anything like that before.
Oh, that's right.
That's great.
And you get to play.
Yeah, yeah. And you put you on your game as well, because people, indeed, like you mentioned, like Brett Gelman, who's a who's a stand-up, so he's got that kind of a brain, so he can just come up with stuff.
Yeah, and really dark, crazy stuff.
Dark, crazy, funny stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and his background is also UCB, so there's like a strong improv sketch background,
too.
You know, which is such a great tool to have.
Well, what did you... you did a Neil Gaiman...
Yes.
Yes.
I did. Neil Gaiman, Terry Pratchett's novel, Good Omens, which Neil adapted for Amazon, which is out next year.
So that's so exciting.
I just shot that just before I came over.
Because John Hamm's in that.
John Hamm is there.
I remember when he was going to do that, he was like, I'm going to do Good Omens, Tenet. Right. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, it just sounds like such a dream. Like, first of all, adapting... like, to hear that Neil Gaiman was adapting a Terry Pratchett book into a thing, and that, and just to hear the casting, like, Jesus Christ, like, just it hits every pleasure center.
Well, it's hugely ambitious. I mean, I think they've tried to make some kind of version of this novel several times, and it's been defeated by circumstance. It's massive, and but you know, Amazon wrote a big check and allowed it to happen, and because Neil adapted it, it doesn't. It's very much true to the book that he wrote with Terry Pratchett all those years ago. Wow. And it's got the madness and the kind of freewheeling kind of anarchy to it, and the almost free association, and it just goes to mad places. And I think, well, I hope it'll you know, tick all the boxes, but it was great to do. Yeah,
that's really exciting. Yeah. I think people are going to be really excited. I think people are going to be blown away by that, because I haven't heard much about it, just other than the fact that it was done.
Yeah,
but it was done like a year almost.
Oh, no, we just finished.
Oh, you just finished now? Because he went away for it.
A couple of months ago, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Sheen is the angel, and I'm the devil.
Oh, fantastic.
Miranda Richardson's in it, John Hamm's in it, Michael McKean's in it.
Oh, nice.
Jack Whitehall's in it. Lots of amazing people. And, it's now in post-production, which is where it's going to be for a long time. Yeah. There's a lot of bells and whistles that need to be added on top of
there's some shit happening over your head.
Exactly,
it takes a lot of time to get those star wipes between the scenes.
Yeah.
That is a whole other layer of, like, the technology acting now. I guess ultimately it might be like going back to what I imagine Black Box Theater was, where it's like, oh, you really kind of have to create now it's just like blue or green box.
Yeah.
Where
you're
just like... And also the rate at that, because Douglas McKinnon directed it, who directed a couple of Doctor Who's that I did.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this a lot. Doctor Who, when I did it with him, it was, what would it have been, 2008 maybe? So 10 years ago. And each script would arrive, and there were 7 CGI shots. I think it was 7, maybe it was 8 in each episode. That was it. And they would all be very specifically in block capital letters. Russell would write out each one, and he would mark it as a CGI shot so that everyone knew what they were working to, because that's what the technology and the budget could cope with.
Right. Yeah.
Now, of course, it's every shot's got something. Every single shot has got something in it, whether it's, you know, just somebody's eyebrow doing a funny thing, or somebody's hat doing a funny thing, or a big enormous monster, or something exploding, or it's everything. You know, the guys who, you know, on Doctor Who, Dave Houghton, who used to run that department, would turn up 2 or 3 times a week to do his bit. But they're just there the whole time, these guys. Yeah. Of course they are, because it's everything.
Yeah.
And that's happened so quickly, you know, in relative terms, in terms of how these things have moved on.
But it... You know, I still think... I think we're getting there with CG. I really think we're getting there with CG. Like, they're still really good. But I still, when I watch stuff, I go, oh, that's really great for CG.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's still... I think...
I want it to stay there for the good of humanity. Yeah. I don't want anyone to realistically do something.
To reproduce.
Yeah, there but needs to be some separation.
I do think now that we're in the stage where, yes, I absolutely agree. We think we know what's CG and what's isn't, but I think more and more there's bits going by that we don't realise.
No, you're absolutely right. Like landscapes and,
exactly.
You know, like, oh, there wasn't that building in the background wasn't there.
Yeah.
It's like all the subtle stuff.
Like in Fincher's Zodiac, he did a ton of that stuff where it was just a conversation between two characters, but because it was 70 San Francisco, he didn't think about it when you were watching it, but it was just different storefronts, exactly. And he did a ton of it digitally.
And it's something that happens now on set. You'll sort of do a take, and they'll go, oh, that thing's happening in the corner. And rather than going again, they just go, we'll paint it out.
Yeah.
And it's just because
it's
easier than doing another take.
Yeah.
We are sort of getting there. But I think for now, at least, you still need a bit of a human being in there somewhere.
Hopefully.
Even if it's just to drive it, I don't know.
oh, I didn't say that line right. We'll just fix that.
Yeah, we'll do it in post. We'll paint it out. We'll auto-tune it.
Yeah, we'll just... you'll say it. You'll say it the right way. Yeah. I don't know. I don't feel comfortable with that.
There's some technology, and I can't remember where I saw it, but it was some companies developing a thing where if it's a locked-off shot of an actor, they can kind of layer all a bunch of different takes to get the right kind of take they want. And it was this weird thing where they kind of slightly morphed the face from one take to another take and created a completely different style of a scene than what was actually done.
Isn't this the technology that will then have sort of world leaders coming on TV and telling us we're all going to die when they've never said that?
Yes. That's exactly what my fear is. It's just someone going like, well, and then something could happen and someone says, well, they used that technology. I wasn't really there. That wasn't me.
Well, quite. Works both ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fake news is you're going to go, but we got it on tape. Well, that doesn't mean anything.
But also, that wasn't me watching them.
But also you combine that with like the trigger sensitive, the trigger happy like outrage machine.
Yeah.
Social media. And it's like people I've already crucified someone before like the news comes out. Like, oh, this person never actually said that.
Sorry, too late.
It's a, it's a scary. That's why you have the American version of The Office so that you don't have to think about
it. That takes me to a happy place.
But you do, you are one of those people that can, you can play a nice character so beautifully, and you can play, because Bad Samaritan is, which is the movie that you, ultimately you were, I guess, technically here to promote.
Sure.
But
May 4th in theaters.
May 4th in theaters, directed by Dean Devlin.
Yes.
And written by Boyce, right? The guy who did Milk.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They sent it to me, and it looks like the trailer is super, super unsettling.
It's a good sort of thriller minute. It's a roller coaster ride.
Have you seen the trailer for it yet?
No, I've stopped watching trailers, but I've read about it. I'm going to see it.
I don't watch trailers. Yeah. I think that's a good
thing. I watch teasers, but I don't watch. Like, I didn't watch any of the last couple of Avengers trailers. Like, I'll watch the teaser to just get a vibe, but I don't want to see things that are happening in the movie.
I used to hate people. I was like, I don't watch trailers. I was like, no, they're so fun. And then I went to a film festival and just kind of didn't have time to look at the trailer. So just off the synopsises, I picked all the movies. And it was so great just having a story be told to you without any preconceived notion of any kind of visuals.
Did you ever see Misfits, the BBC series, The Misfits?
No.
It's fantastic.
Robert Sheehan.
Yes. So the star of Bad Samaritan was in this show called Misfits, which is, I think they only did for a couple seasons, but it's really quickly, you would love it.
Yeah.
But it's basically this group of kind of degenerate youths on like a work program. They get like hit by lightning or something. They get zapped and they get these really weirdly specific to their personality superpowers.
Yeah.
And but they're all kind of fuck ups, and it's great. And Robert Sheen is great.
He's great.
And he's the his character in Bad Samaritan. I mean, I don't want to talk over you. Do you want to explain it? He's a thief, and
he's a valet
who will he'll get in the car and then hit home, and then while a person's in the restaurant, go rob their house.
Oh, great!
Bring the car back.
Yeah.
And so he does that with David's character, and it's some shit goes sideways.
Yeah. He shouldn't have crossed me.
Do you like doing the American accent?
I do quite enjoy doing the American accent. Yeah.
What does it sound like to you in your head?
Erna, or you heard it. I don't know. I mean, we grew up on American movies, so anywhere in the world pretty much does, didn't they? So it feels familiar enough, I guess.
Yeah, it's just, so many British actors come to the States and play like Southern characters.
Right.
But there are so few. I think maybe Peter Dinklage might be the guy who is an acceptable British accent.
Yeah. Gwyneth Paltrow does a cracker.
Oh, really? Yeah.
She did Sliding Doors.
Sliding Doors.
Emma, and she's very good.
That's right.
And, what's her name? Bridget Jones.
Oh, Renee Zellweger. She did a good one, too.
Fantastic, yeah.
But see, the thing is, I think our ears, we can't discern. I mean, I think there are obvious regional accents that we can pick out. Like Liverpool obviously is a little different than a Welsh accent's a little different, but I'm sure there are subtleties that if someone's like, oh, hello, it's like, okay, well, that was four accents that you just did.
Yes, but I'm sure that's true the other way as well. We all tend to move towards some kind of general American sort of But then over here, it seems to me that accents are quite, I mean, obviously there are regional, there are regions which are very specific, but there's quite a sort of middle melting potty sort of neutral accent, I think.
Was there ever any conversation to play the Doctor with just your Scottish accent?
There never ever was, which now, just 10 years later, feels a bit weird, actually.
Yeah.
It was always, I think it came off the back of Chris doing a Northern accent and that being something that was commented on positively, very much so. And I think they thought, well, let's not do that again.
Right.
And then, of course, when Peter Capaldi did it, he went, nobody even commented on it.
Right,
And it made me think, why did we do that? I mean, to be honest, I was very happy. I quite like using accents. It makes me feel like I'm being an actor, doing acting. It feels like there's a bit of a transformation going on and that it takes you to a slightly different place in your head. So I didn't fight it at all. And I wouldn't want to do it any differently. But it is weird that we just sort of did that. It feels like if we did it just these few years later, we wouldn't do that.
I mean, I had no idea that you were... when I first started watching you on the show, I had no idea that you were Scottish. I just thought, he's an English guy. Yeah. Nope, not at all.
I mean, Jodie Whittaker, for instance, has a very strong Northern accent. And I don't... Mind you, I don't know for certain, but I she talks like that.
Right.
And I think she's going to continue to talk like that as the Doctor.
Did you go to that breakfast that... Did you go?
Yeah, you were meant to be there.
I was meant to be there.
We sent you a message.
You did send me a message. Yeah. Yes, I... I chose a Red Nose Day, which I'm hosting again this year. Yeah. And Richard Curtis is the mastermind behind Red Nose Day. He's a very famous British writer and director. He directed, he wrote Notting Hill. So his girlfriend, Emma Freud, of Freud, she was sort of booking all these really great, if you donate to Red Nose Day, you'll get this and you'll get that. And there was a seat at a table for as many living doctors as they could get together in one thing. And I go, she goes, they'll all be there. And I go, but I don't know if I can go anytime soon. No, we'll do it next year. It'll be, we'll help try to work it around your schedule. I go, great. And then in November, I get an email. Well, it's in 2 weeks. I'm
you weren't even consulted.
No, but here's the thing. She was so apologetic and tried so hard to make me feel included. And I was like, it's fine. I felt weird about going anyway. only because I get kind of shy, and I also am a little embarrassed that I'm such a big Doctor Who fan that when I do run into you, sometimes I'm like, oh, God, because I just don't want to be the, here's that guy again. So I was kind of like, no, it's fine. It's totally fine that I wasn't there
You were very much missed.
But here's the thing that I discovered that I need to tell Emma was that I think she is under the impression that I had made this very large donation and didn't get to go. And when I was doing my taxes for the end of the year, I was like, and I made this donation to Red Nose or to Comic Relief. And my business manager was like, I don't see that anywhere. So I need to let Emma know, you didn't even get the donation from me. It's fine.
Oh, right.
So.
Oh, yeah. Well, you weren't welcome at all. Yeah, forget about it. Can't believe we did your message.
Now I'm gonna donate now because you did the message.
Sure.
I'm gonna donate now. How was the breakfast?
It was great. It was lovely. It was really good fun.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
And we had Peter Purvis and Freema Agyeman, two of the doctors.
Oh, yes.
Nice.
Serving.
Oh, that's really funny.
It was great.
That's
was
really funny. Were the people that paid for the seats, were they sort of good-natured?
Oh, they were lovely. They were lovely, yeah. Yeah. Some people had paid vast sums of money, and some people had entered the raffle.
Right.
There were two ways of winning a seat at the table. You could either be really rich or really lucky.
I have to say, one of the great things about that fandom, about the Doctor Who fandom, is that it is a very lovely group of fans.
Absolutely.
Because I think the show has such a beautiful message, and he has such a fascination and hope for humanity. And it is, that show was inclusive for races, ethnicities, and sexuality. And in a way that wasn't look what we're doing. It's just very matter of fact. Captain Jack Harkness just happened to be this sort of pansexual.
Yeah, yeah.
There was never any, didn't make a big deal out of it. And I always thought that was so beautiful in the way that,
Absolutely.
That the way that, the old Star Treks, any of the old shows that tried to show people, this is how you should live.
Yeah.
You know?
No, absolutely. It's always been a show for the underdog, really, I think. Mm-hmm.
And it's a good group. And are you, do you, when you went back for the 50th, was it emotional in any way or sort of like, oh, I get to play again. I get to put the jacket back on.
It was, I mean, more the latter, I think, because it wasn't like entirely going back, because it wasn't my show anymore. It was Matt's show. And I was quite nervous about that because you thought this, he might feel like I'm stepping on his toes. It's quite a weird sort of, you know, he now plays the Doctor. It's, yeah, and I'm sort of coming in and kind of, he might feel like I'm elbowing my way into his space. But we actually just got on so well and had such a fun time that it was genuinely joyful to go back and do that.
That's good. Great. Well, yeah, I have to say that all of you embody, like, it's so nice to know that you and Matt and Peter and, you know, everyone that I've ever met that's involved with the show really loves the show as much as the fans do. And I think that also kind of makes it special, too.
Yeah, I think we all do. And it was lovely to be reunited. Whenever I see anyone from that show again, there's a real sort of, there's a kind of, you feel like you're part of a special club.
You are part of a special club.
Yeah.
And also, people should watch you be an empathetic villain in Bad Samaritan, or just a villain?
No, he's a cunt.
Well, thanks for the new ringtone.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yep, thanks for the new ringtone. It's charming when you say
what
it.
What you can also see, though, if I may be so bold.
Please.
Because it's on Showtime in this lovely country. It's in the cinemas back home in the UK. But my wonderful wife is now a film producer.
Oh, wow.
And employed me in her first feature film. And it's now, and Showtime have bought it, so you can get it on Showtime on demand here. It's called You, Me and Him, and it's a romantic comedy with Lucy Punch.
Oh, great.
Who's magnificent. And Faye Marseille, who you may know from Game of Thrones. And me as the third wheel. and that's now showing on Showtime on demand, so that's worth checking
out. Great. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I know.
Listen,
she's very clever.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's really great. And I'm, you know, every
time. Get married, get a job out of it. That's the long game.
That's the long game.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, I'm married way above my. I'm swinging way beyond my whatever the sports metaphor is in my marriage. So I feel like, you know. I feel like I'm saying the same thing that you were saying.
Yeah.
But that's a very important thing to do. Mm. Someday, because she's starting to produce stuff too, and I'm just like, just put me in a movie. No one puts me in a movie. Just let me. Just I'll be in the background eating a churro. Yeah. I don't care.
I know, it's great. Marry someone who puts you in a movie. That's I mean, I didn't know it was coming. Who knew she was going to become a producer? But it turns out she's really good at it. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for...
That's it. Are we done?
That's it.
My goodness.
But you can, you know, we can play pinball if you want to hang out.
Sure.
I already showed him the TARDIS downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I just wanted to get that out. I would have felt bad about it not mentioning it the whole time.
Yeah, if he found it on his own, it would have been weird.
What is this? this is not mine.
Yeah.
I learned this from watching you. David Tennant, thank you so much for being
My
here.
Pleasure.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Bad Samaritan, May 4th.
That's it. May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you. Oh, very important day.
Oh,
very good. All right. Thanks, everyone. The end.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges. They will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.